Every couple I have worked with who is struggling with a communication breakdown has a problem in at least one of these areas. Generally, we are high achievers and are activating more than one, if not all of them. Figuring out where the breakdown is occurring informs the strategies to repair it. As an example, let's go back to the dinner example previously mentioned. 1. What you mean to say. For example, if you don't express yourself well, being more measured and considered before responding can make a huge difference. Dinner example? Maybe growing up you weren't allowed to voice much opinion, or you think your answers are wrong. Maybe you get up in your head about what you want and get paralyzed when trying to communicate. It's okay to say, "Good question, let me think a minute." Then actually check in on yourself. Maybe you really want pizza and should say that. Maybe you don't care super much, as long as it isn't tacos, since that's what you had for lunch. 2. What you actually say. Here is where you gotta use your words. Instead of mumble, like pizza? Or maybe tacos, if that's what you want. Chinese food? There's soup left in the fridge. Say the truth. Like, "I've been jonesing for deep dish all day." Or, "I had tacos at lunch, so anything other than Mexican food sounds good." Clear communication means that partner person doesn't have to figure out which answer is the correct one. 3. What the other person hears. We all have our own interpretations, filters, and distractions. For this example, let's say partner person hears, "I've had tacos for lunch," but not the "anything other than Mexican food sounds good" part, and suggests fajitas for dinner. Then do a gentle correction. And if it's a continued problem, and you were discussing far bigger issues than dinner plans, it might help to ask your partner to repeat back in their words what you just told them. As in, "I heard you say." 4. What your partner thinks you mean. So many people have had past relationships where all responses were a death trap and they were supposed to mind read and interpret everything that was told to you, and there was hell to pay if you didn't. If you have a partner that overinterprets what you say, they may benefit from a reminder that you are responsible for your responses and they don't have to mind read. If you say, "Anything for dinner is fine," and you really mean pizza, you better fucking say pizza. Or not bitch when you get tacos for 2 meals in a row, right? Beyond the basics, more notes on resolving conflict. Man, relationships are kind of a dick move when you think about it. Our partners see the absolute worst side of us when they are the people we love best and who love us best. We are nicer to the bratty toddler running through the aisles at Target than we are to Boo, who has seen us upchuck at 3 o'clock in the morning, smelled our morning breath, and cleaned our pee off the toilet seat. And to be fair, Boo does the same to us. It's human nature to be toughest on the people we are closest to. This is why we tend to pick fights with our mate more than anyone else. Not that Boo is perfect, or that you are the epitome of grace, elegance, and sweet-smelling morning breath. But we do tend to fuck with each other way more than necessary. Of course, when someone is your partner, you are having to constantly negotiate and navigate boundaries. Of course. And it's an ongoing process, as relationships are fluid entities that are always morphing and reshaping themselves as we live in them. But what really needs to be navigated? And when can you just let Boo be Boo? When things go sideways, try asking yourself these questions. Is it intentional? Is your partner intentionally fucking with you? Like deliberately disrespecting your time, resources, needs, and desires? Like, "I know we had dinner plans, but I went out drinking instead because fuck you." You have every right to be mad. But also, what the actual literal hell are you doing with this person? If they have no fucks to give about what's important to you, get out. Believe what they are showing you about who they are. Call your bestie to request sofa surfing privileges, pack up your pooch, polish your tiara, and move on. Fighting is worthless here, because you are being treated like you are worthless here. Don't fight with someone who has made it clear that they don't care. Grown-ass people are not intentionally dicks. Well, there are a few, and they are often running for political office, so voter beware. And that's a good rule of thumb in general, isn't it? If you wouldn't vote for someone, you sure as hell shouldn't give them the privilege of seeing you naked, for fuck's sake. Who you really mad at, Cupcake? Remember learning about Freud's defense mechanisms in Psych 101? Okay, he was a crazy motherfucker who snorted too much coke, but he was right on about that shit. Displacement is a defense mechanism where we attack the safe target rather than the real cause of distress. Of course, you can't tell your boss that his mother was a hamster and his father smelt of elderberries. So you get home already riled up and ready to rumble. Boo tells you they forgot to pick up your dry cleaning, and you find yourself spewing venom like a champ. If you know you are ripe for a fight, like after a hard day, do what you need to do to decompress that doesn't involve sniping at partner person, and warn them that you are wound tight. It's totally okay to say a discussion needs to be put in the parking lot for the rest of the day. Just tell your partner that's on you. Something to the end of, I'm so upset, I'm afraid I'll be hurtful or mean in ways that I don't really feel. And I know I won't communicate well right now. I'm gonna go soak in the tub and figure out why I'm so upset. I don't think this is all about you. Can we talk about this later? The big thing is actually setting a date for later. Don't use that as a sidestep technique to never have difficult conversations. Humor rather than snipe. I suck at hanging towels up to dry. I tend to leave them sitting in the sink. I'm trying to be better at that, but I had years of living alone and not sharing that bathroom with anyone. And it doesn't bother me. I'm probably going to use that towel to mop up the floor before I throw it in the laundry anyway, which also grosses him out, but that's another story. If I forget to hang up the towel, he will tease me into remembering rather than yell, "Who hates to hang up towels?" And I'll wave my hand in the air and say, "Me, me!" It's obnoxiously cute, but it is way preferable to a stupid fight over a stupid thing, right? I remember to go hang up the towel, and neither one of us feels irritated in the process. Now, someone else having the same conversation might mean it in a mean, snarky, or demeaning way. He's being silly about it, and I take it in kind. The important point is that you find a way to communicate without the sniping, and finding avenues that rely on your shared sense of humor can really help. I've been working with a couple on communicating better with I statements. Remember those? You just listen to them, right? I made a joke about how, "I feel you're an asshole," is not an I statement. That cracked them up so much, it's been a line they use to diffuse tension during tense conversations at home. Well, "I feel that you're being an asshole" has become their in-joke that diffuses the fight. Beware the horseman. John Gottman, who I invoked in the introduction to this book, is famous for saying he can predict divorce with 90% accuracy. All his research led him to develop what he terms the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Of his four horsemen, he has found one to be more destructive than all the others. After criticism, defensiveness, and stonewalling, the biggest relationship destroyer is the horseman of contempt. Contemptuous language, that is, communication that demonstrates you don't respect your partner's choices, not only becomes a pattern of negative dialogue between the two of you, it reinforces thinking about and seeing the negative in your partner. John Gottman also says that the 90% accuracy rate is predicated on people not changing. If you notice a level of contempt, not frustration with their choices, but an actual disgust with them as a human being, ask yourself, is this something that you think you can change with a shift in perspective? If not, you have a pretty good idea about the path you are on. Ask for what you need and negotiate on things that are straight up preferences. Communicate your hard limits, going back to boundaries, and ask your partner about theirs. If you can't honor these needs in each other and don't think that you would ever be able to, time to abort mission. If someone's needs for safety outweigh your capacity to give, that is not your fault or theirs. Maybe they have a trauma history that needs more work before they can regain equilibrium. It just is what it is. And like everything else about the human experience, it may change over time. Admit when it changes. Ask for a renegotiation. Be vulnerable enough to ask for support. I have a toilet paper roll holder that hangs over the side of the toilet tank. Mr. Intimacy Doctor hates the thing because he has to twist around to reach the roll. First world problems, maybe, but he prefers to have the roll sitting on the counter next to the toilet. What kind of monster does that? I don't like that because it gets damp there. Again, first world problems. Guess what? We have two rolls of toilet paper in the bathroom, one sitting on the counter and one hanging on the holder. Boom! We are all set in our ways and have our preferences. They aren't worth fighting about. We all have our idiosyncrasies. Being our own weird and individual selves doesn't mean we are intentionally fucking with our mate. It means we have years of behavior patterns that are really hard to change. Ever tried to give up tacos for Lent? You feel me, right? Mr. Intimacy Doctor and I are pains in the asses in a million different ways, but battle stations are only activated when there is a cost beyond irritation involved. For example, Mr. Dr. Faith has dish duty here at the underground headquarters of Sexy Times. I cook, he cleans. Modern romance. He has a tendency to put off the hand washables like my kitchen knives and cutting boards because they are a pain. This makes me nuts, because I like to head into a clean kitchen to start my next day of oven sorcery. Blech, irritating. But not the end of the world. However, he got in a habit of leaving them soaking for a couple days at a time. I had to get all the knives resharpened and had to completely toss a few of the cutting boards. So yeah, that was worth a different kind of discussion. I growled and stomped and muttered and griped. Mr. Dr. Faith has worked really hard at not leaving dishes hanging around near as long since that episode. And if he doesn't get to the hand washables, he puts them up behind the sink so they don't soak and get ruined. And if I need them in the meantime, I wash them myself. What tends to be your relational sticking points? For a lot of people, it's how money is spent. That may mean having an agreement on allowances, meaning coming up with an amount that each can spend without checking in with the other based on what you can afford and your financial goals as a couple. Sex troubles? Try out some of the Sensate Focus exercises in this book to rebuild physical connection. Parenting teenagers? Ugh, good luck on that one. No matter how big or small, look at what the actual cost of the issue is before you decide how to proceed. It's amazing how much can be let go when you do that. Is it Netflix and chill night, and you want pizza but Boo wants Chinese? Just get both. Honestly, my goal in life is to have my house be a peaceful abode. I want it to be my favorite place in the world to be. My spouse feels the same, so we work hard at setting up our relationship so we maintain that peace. Try it at your home. It's a pretty nice way to live. Cheating. People cheat. Rates of infidelity vary widely, and research does demonstrate that men cheat more than women. About 40% of men and 25% of women report having violated an agreement of monogamy with a partner overall, and that difference is more pronounced in same-gender relationships, where only 28% of women, but 82% of men report having cheated. As irritating as it is for a feminist to admit, there are marked differences on a global scale between men's level of sexual desire and women's. Men think about sex more, want sex more, use porn more, masturbate more, etc., etc., and that's related to testosterone production. And while I haven't seen any research, I have had many trans male and trans mask people tell me, anecdotally, that starting T revved up their sex drive substantially. If the desire for something is higher, so is the likelihood of engaging in that desire. That doesn't let us women off the hook, though. When we cheat, it is far more likely to be an affair with a lot of emotional depth, which is far more difficult to recover from. You may have picked up this audiobook specifically for this reason. A lot of the people I see in my practice ended up there because of infidelity in their relationship, and they are now trying to figure out if the relationship is repairable or should be repairable. Of course, all good therapists steal from other therapists. And in that grand tradition, it's important for me to note that the work I do with people after infidelity is grounded mostly in the research and therapeutic approaches of Barry McCarthy and Snyder, Baucom, and Gordon. Both ground their therapeutic work in treating infidelity as a form of interpersonal trauma to the partner who was cheated on. I am first and foremost a trauma therapist, so this approach makes intuitive sense to me. But I also take a step further and presume the event was also traumatic to the partner who cheated. And I know I may have lost some of y'all there. And yes, I realize some people are just shitty human beings who have no regard for the feelings of others, no remorse for their behavior, and are just mad as fuck for getting busted. And it's also true that those aren't the people trying to do the relationship repair work. If that's the case in your relationship, the hard truth is that you don't really have a relationship based on value of you and respect for your needs. You've been handed an ultimatum, and you need to decide if it's one you can live with. For everyone else, yes, the person who was cheated on is clearly unequivocally injured by what happened. But so was the person who cheated. They did something that was out of alignment to commitments they made and their personal ethical code. It's a form of moral injury that also requires attention and work. When working with individuals in affair recovery, as opposed to the couple, I have more clients that were the person who cheated than the person who was cheated on. Even people who were no longer with the partner they cheated on, because they wanted to figure out what had happened and they didn't want to ever do that again. If they couldn't repair that partnership, they were determined to never hurt anyone else in the same way. And for the record, I can't even begin to say how impressed I am with the level of emotional maturity that takes. The good news? Research demonstrates that most relationships do recover from an affair. People fuck up. The original school of therapeutic thought was that cheating doomed everything, and it was time to just go into divorce doula mode with the unhappy couple, and nothing is further from the truth. But there are definitely certain things that will greatly increase your chances of surviving, repairing, and being stronger going forward. First, you need to deal with the emotional upheaval. Shit is usually intensely volatile when everything originally comes out. It's generally helpful to not try to make big decisions during this time period. It's okay to grieve and focus on self-care until you both feel you can commit to communicating with each other more effectively, with or without a therapist present. This may mean taking a break from each other. It definitely means no screaming, rage quits, and text message fighting. I promise you, I have never seen anything accomplished by anyone engaged in those types of communication. Going back to your own self-compassion work in the process can be of great benefit for feeling what you were feeling without becoming overwhelmed in the process. Don't open wounds unnecessarily. You need to focus on what caused the affair to happen and what needs to prevent it from happening in the future. I have seen lots of people become very wrapped up in needing to know all kinds of details about the affair. And I get the impulse. I really, really do. I know that at some level, the person who was cheated on wants to feel back in control of the situation, and knowing all the details seems to give a sense of that, in theory. I also know that they think it will help them make a better decision about whether or not they want to repair the relationship or split up. I'm not the decider, so I'm not going to stop you from demanding all the details. But just like getting stuck in a volatile emotional state, I've never seen anyone gain benefit from going through all the minutiae of the affair. It generally only serves to re-wound them over and over again. Remember that you can't unhear information that you ask for, so you need to decide if this information is truly part of your decision-making process, or is it just haunting details? What kind of information about the affair might be integral to your decision-making process? Some things that bear consideration. Is there some evidence that the affair was an escape hatch activity? That is there any indication that the cheating partner was looking for the relationship eject button and decided this would do the trick? Was the affair with someone with a gender different than that of the partner that was cheated on? That is there a question about the cheating partner's sexual orientation that needs to be explored? Has the affair ended? Is there any contact with the person with whom the cheating partner had the affair? Is there any contact with the partner between them and the person who was cheated on? Were drugs, alcohol, or anything else that induces an altered state of consciousness involved? Were barrier protection methods to minimize the risk for STIs used during sexual relations, condoms, dams, etc.? Was the affair an ongoing relationship or a more limited interaction? Was the affair sought out in a considered way, or did it happen based on opportunity? Did the affair contain, or even solely consist of, emotional content? That is, was it just sex, or was it a relationship? This isn't to say that specific answers equate with breakup or stay. I wish it were that easy, but it's definitely not. And if you are going through this right now or have in the past, I don't need to tell you how something that seems like it should be a clear-cut decision is actually one of the hardest decisions you will ever make, no matter what you decide in the end. The point of these questions is to give everyone involved an idea of what you are working with, without getting stuck in the quicksand of the minutiae of the affair. And if the plan is to move forward and repair the relationship, the information gathered based on the previous conversations will inform what kind of safety plan needs to be put into place to keep the relationship strong. If you and your partner decide to move forward, unpacking the impetus of the affair will be instrumental in reducing the risk of affair relapse. I have found over and over again that something was going on either with the person having the affair or within the relationship itself, which led to looking for something to make them feel better. Usually not even sex, just attention, someone to listen to them, someone to make them feel special and important, etc. But when you start heading down that road, the risk is that you end up slipping and falling into a puddle of sex. And it happens over and over again. So repair is best based on strengthening the original relationship and learning to communicate through disconnection. This means that genuine ownership of what caused the affair needs to occur. This means the partner who had the affair needs to take responsibility for their actions, understand what drove these behaviors, request forgiveness, genuinely from the partner he cheated on, and commit to doing the work necessary to re-secure their bond and prevent further episodes of cheating. This means the partner who was cheated on has to believe them. The apology has to be accepted and trusted as sincere, and the partner who was cheated on has to be equally committed to strengthening the relationship and reconnecting to the person who hurt them. This is a fundamental shift away from how things usually play out that can't be overstated. The affair has to stop being defined as the central element of the relationship, but a consequence of disconnection. This means working on where the relationship is now, in the present, and planning for the future. It means bringing back basics like date nights. And it means things to rebuild emotional and physical intimacy, such as the sensate focus activities discussed in a later chapter, which may feel awkward and difficult after everything that happened. Without this commitment by both parties, the chances of authentic relationship repair are pretty fucking slim. I mean, You might stay together while you continue to harbor deep rage, shame, guilt, fear, and pain. But that's not relationship repair. Bravery and vulnerability requires commitment and strength from everyone involved. Sex addiction and porn addiction doesn't exist. Yeah, I said it. This chapter is right after the cheating chapter for very good reasons. Cheating and other behaviors around sex, high sex drive, porn use, masturbation, have been attributed to sex addiction ever increasingly over recent decades. It's a multi-billion dollar treatment industry based on something that literally doesn't exist. I have many people come to see me because their behavior regarding sex or porn is really pissing off their partner. The word addiction starts getting thrown around, and the doer gets an ultimatum that shits over if they don't get therapy for their problem. There is one thing that needs to be said first. Wanting sex, enjoying sex, and being excited about sex does not make you a sex addict. Having cheated on a partner means you did something shitty to someone you love, but it doesn't make you a sex addict. Wanting porn, enjoying porn, and being excited about porn does not make you a porn addict. Alfred Kinsey, hey there, again, toothbrush dude, once remarked that a nymphomaniac is someone who has more sex than you do. Let me say that one more time for the people in the back. Being sex and porn positive does not an addiction make. Does sex addiction exist? Not according to the research. So a therapist shouldn't diagnose you with a sex or porn addiction because the diagnosis doesn't exist. It doesn't compute the same way when there is no physiological dependence and the consequences don't seem as severe. As an aside, all those numbers being thrown around relating porn usage to divorces are entirely made up by anti-porn crusaders. They could fall under the domain of process addictions, which means there is no involvement of a substance that creates a literal physical dependency, like alcohol, nicotine, and other drugs, but the behavior itself has addictive qualities. The problem is, when the brain lights up in the process of doing something like shoe shopping or gambling, it's easy to see the reward circuit being activated in a way it doesn't for someone who doesn't share that process addiction. But sex, solo or partnered, is supposed to light up the reward centers of the brain. Everyone's brains light up that way. So can you safely label it an addiction? No. Can someone be engaging in sexual behaviors that are of determinant to their relationships or other life domains? Sure. But calling it what it really is very important. Dismissing problematic behaviors as addiction operates as a denial of responsibility and a declaration of a lack of self-control, and that right there is some fucking bullshit. Anyone who is engaging in problematic behavior around sex is absolutely accountable for their behavior and absolutely able to recognize their urges and consider how acting on them will impact their partners and their lives in general in the long term. First of all, if you are worried that you may fall into the sex or porn problematic usage category, there are a few good self-assessment tools you can find online. Use your Google foo to check them out. I've had people come to my office and announce a number associated with a self-assessment, and I've told them I don't give a shit. The point isn't to get a particular score that gives you a diagnosis, but to start a conversation. I use the answers to help them discover patterns of behavior in order to create better strategies around the actions that are causing harm. Here is the big thing I want you to look at. How sex and porn either hinder or support your relationships. Because in the end, all addictions are replacement relationships. They become more important than the people we love. They become more important than we are ourselves and prevent us from being a human being out there connecting in the world. Questions to consider. Is sexual activity itself, either partnered sex or solo sex that is porn-stimulated, more important than the person with whom you are having sex? Does it take the place of true connection? Are you experiencing a lot of life stress right now? Or depression or grief or anything else that's really difficult to deal with and have started using porn and solo sex more than usual as a coping skill? Are you skipping out on other important things in your life because of your behavior around sex and porn? Be honest. Were you late to grandma's birthday dinner because you were all engrossed in X-Tube last weekend? Are you feeling out of control of your behavior? Instead of seeing sex and porn as another way of expressing who you are as a person, like, is it costing you money you don't have or causing legal consequences? Is it something you use for connection and or fun, or is it a compulsion you fight with every day? Is your behavior at odds with what your partner thinks is appropriate? Your church, your family, your community? Is this about other people's core values or your own? Problematic use of sex, masturbation, and or porn comes about when the thing we are doing becomes more important than all of our reasons for being, and all of the meaning of our behaviors are drained of context. I don't know anyone who is unhappy with their usage of sex and or porn who actually likes what they are doing. Not past the immediate moment of engagement, anyway. And they don't like themselves all too much either, because their behavior is separating them from all the amazing, messy, authentic, beautiful relationships the world has to offer. It's no longer aligned with their values and keeps them from prioritizing the people they love. That's what defines a problem. If you are realizing that your current sexual activities are posing a problem for you, then it may be of benefit to get some support. I know one of the biggest problems in this area is the number of clinicians have ended up profiting on the stigma and shame surrounding sex, which means that this is an area where doing careful research will be really important. Ask any therapist that you are interested in seeing what their stance on sex addiction and porn usage is. If you are dealing with past religious or cultural messages around your sex and pornography usage, ask them if they are comfortable with helping you explore that issue without adding their own value system to the conversation. I recently read an article by a therapist who views masturbation as a form of spousal abuse. Yes, literally. People are out there spewing that kind of nonsense, and there is enough shame and stigma around sex out there. You sure as fuck don't need it from your therapist. Resolving to partner better. Resolution making is just that fun game we like to play with ourselves every January in order to set ourselves up for failure. By February, the sneakers are back in the closet and the tacos are back on the table. Because seriously, fuck Pilates and kale. But proactively working on better relationship habits really should be a year-round enterprise, not something that rots in the crisper like that arugula you bought in a fit of piety. It's always ongoing work, especially for those of us who didn't have great role models in that regard and are having to be proactive in our desire to be healthier in our relationships than what we saw around us growing up. Here's some ideas to get you started. Time together. And I don't mean collapsed on the sofa, streaming Ugly Delicious on Netflix, and eating ice cream in your stained sweats with Boo by your side. And if that is how y'all roll, you are clearly destined to be couple besties with Mr. Dr. Harper and myself. But real planned couples time. Your mate deserves to be wooed. And so do you. This doesn't mean fancy. It just means intentional. It doesn't matter if it's a walk in the park or ice cream cones. It means respecting your relationship enough to make time for it. The way you do everything else of importance in your life. Do you make an appointment when you go see your dentist? Plan in your schedule to run to Trader Joe's for groceries? Isn't Boo worth at least as much consideration? Make a plan to do something together once a week. It can even be home if that is how life is rolling right now. But make a plan. Not a Gilmore Girls default setting. Whether it be date night at Hot Joy, coffee at Rosella before hitting the latest Sama exhibit, or Netflix and chill, do it in an organized way. Hey, Boo, Tuesdays are a pretty light day for us. I'm gonna get a bottle of wine and some takeout pho. Let's stream that movie we missed in the theater that you were wanting to see then. Date night. Not just for dating anymore. Time apart. This is stupid important if you and Boo share a living space, and especially if you have kids. Once a week, you should each have a chance to escape the house alone, and once a week, you should have a chance to have the house to yourself alone. I know how hard this is to do, but if you make an effort, you will do way better than you are doing right now, I imagine. It doesn't have to be complicated time. Doesn't matter if you want to go wander Target with a Starbucks in hand for an hour alone, we all need time that is just ours. Same with time alone in the house. Doesn't matter if you do laundry and watch Mozart in the Jungle with the cat. The house, alone. No judgments on how you spend that time. It's all yours. Mr. Dr. Harper, as I mentioned, is a writer. He's good about putting on headphones and writing away while sitting in his lair while I am streaming Sonny Ozell, arguing with a teenager, and banging pots and pans in the kitchen. Never mind my incessant phone ringing and booping through all this. Once a week, I take the bratty teenager out with me to run errands and let him have the house in peace. He may actually write. He may take a bath, watch a movie, nap with a cat. But the time is all his with no judgments on how he uses that. We all need that time to reboot, recharge, and be good partners. Keep your relationship in your relationship. I wrote an article about this topic in response to a few people I saw publicly trashing their partner on a regular basis. Of course, they didn't read the article or think it applied to them, and that's to be expected. But these same people? Increasingly miserable. Broken up with the aforementioned partner or quite nearly there. Always unhappy. Always complaining. Spending more time than necessary with their own therapists. Physically unwell, accident prone, just ugh. Is this a magic cure for not tripping over sidewalk cracks? Of course not. But if you are connected to your authentic self, aware of what is important in your life, and intentionally making good decisions about your relationships, life will be easier. Life is already difficult enough, Cupcake. For reals. Stop making it worse. And if Boo sucks that bad, get the fuck out. Stop being happy only when you're miserable. And stop bringing the people who care about you along for the ride. Being a more excellent you. When I asked on social media what relational resolutions people had, it was mostly my single friends that answered in detail. Common theme in their answers? Being the best person they could be in order to be open to an excellent potential partner. Fuck yeah, rock star! Do you know what rocks? You not expecting a mate to fix everything wrong in your life. You doing that shit yourself. You know what happens when you are a jacked-up mess? Your bat signal attracts the same. This is excellent advice whether you are single or already partnered. Actively work on your shit. That's the theoretical point of New Year's resolutions, am I right? No one says you have to be perfect. Mr. Dr. Harper loves me for my flabby belly and scrawny butt. Not because he finds them empirically sexy, but to each their own, if that's your thing. But because they are attached to someone who has worked hard to build a life they are excited about. We are both people with goals we go after with full force. We take responsibility for our fuck-ups and help each other be better people. This may mean never trusting him to take the trash out in the morning, no matter how much he swears he won't forget. But hey, healthy doesn't mean flawless. I have had clients come see me after being so fucking tired of ruining relationship after relationship because they hadn't worked on their own shit. And it's so cool to see them do that work and then, at some point, tell me with enormous surprise that they met someone amazing and are building a great relationship. I told them about my history and they stuck around. Of course they did, because your history stopped defining you. And they know they are dating a human being working on their own shit. And you deserve someone great. and they deserve someone as great as you. So hit the Pilates and the kale if that makes you feel better connected to your body. Take a cooking class, go to therapy, learn French, sign up for OkCupid. Go on a date that's just a date. Yes, you have baggage. Your job is to carry your own rather than expect someone else to show up with a trolley. Parents are intimate too, theoretically. So sick of blog posts with titles like, "Parents tell what sex is really like after having kids," I'm over here thinking, there's sex? At Stella G. Maddox. Whatever sexual history, hang-ups, shame issues, shitty messages, etc., you already had about sex can come crashing in full force once you add a parenting role to the mix. When we talk about sex after having kids, we are generally talking about moms who gave birth, how your body changes during pregnancy, what lingers after, especially if you are breastfeeding or chest feeding. There's also lots of great information out there specific to those changes and needs, so I'm not going there. Because there are all kinds of ways of becoming a parent or parental figure. Maybe you're fostering, adopting, in a relationship with someone who has kids from a previous partnership. No matter how they got there, there are kids living up in your house. Grimy, sticky human beings with shit boundaries, and that puts a damper on sex. Getting your groove back takes concerted effort. I see a lot of people in my practice who are working on this particular issue. It's a big deal, so I really wanted to focus on the more general helpful strategies that I've incorporated into my private practice work. The very biggest thing? Take care of each other first. Then, as a team, put the kids first. I don't think this can be overstated. I also think it will earn me some angry tweetbacks. But yeah, I don't think your kids should be your priority if you have a partner. A partnership is two people teaming up against the world. By definition, that's the person who should come first. This does not make you a bad person. It makes you a wonder twin. Your powers are far magnified when combined. And yeah, I realize this analogy falls apart once we start talking about sex. Sorry about that. You need to remain connected to your partner on all accounts, not just making sure you continue to bump uglies. Keep each other in the loop and connected to your daily life. Talk about things other than the kids. Remember when you had an existence outside of big person who keeps little person alive? If you are a stay-at-home parent, that may seem super difficult. But there is generally enough politically going on right now to find some conversation that doesn't revolve around the crust removal of peanut butter sandwiches. Give each other breaks. Ideally, each adult in the house gets time in the house by themselves and time out of the house by themselves. Have stuff that just belongs to the two of you. It may be a show that you only watch together. Nothing fancy. But most importantly, let the idea of spontaneity go. You are gonna have to plan for this shit for up to a couple of decades. The era of spontaneity is over. The era of scarcity hath begun. The chances of being able to just have sex on a Tuesday evening? Because you feel like it after the Daily Show is over? Remember those days? Bye-bye. So many people resent the hell out of having to plan their sex lives. We have to plan our sex lives for many other reasons, but being a parent just proves the rule that a healthy sex life takes work and effort. If you are willing to put in that work, you can still have a fulfilling sexual relationship with your partner. Some things that help. Prioritize everything. By prioritize, I mean figure out what is important and what isn't. I promise it isn't all as important as it may feel in the moment. Prioritize the chores in their rightful place. Prioritize meal prep time. Crockpots are your friend, y'all, into its rightful place. Prioritize TV time, gaming time, scrolling aimlessly through your phone time, etc. All down low, low, low on the agenda. Vegging out and/or getting distracted with other stuff is easy to do. It takes mindfulness to look for pockets of time for intimacy. Change your definition of sex. I realize that is a theme so common throughout this book that seeing it in print again is utterly boring. But seriously, there are tons of ways to have sex. And if sex is off the table, add some more touch into your day with your partner, whether formal sensate focus or kids in view cuddling. The point is to stay physically connected. Plan date nights. Even if you can't afford a sitter, at least plan after the kids are in bedtime together that's intentional. Intentional is the key word. It can totally be popcorn, Netflix, and cuddles. But make it an official date. No phones out. No other distractions. Spend time talking about things other than the kids. Y'all, I know. That's been the sum total of everything the both of you are focused on as a couple. It will feel weird. Do it anyway, even if it's just talking about a book you're reading or a podcast you are listening to. Get back in your partner's life. Have a lock on the bedroom door. And a sound machine, radio, or large fan for noise management. You can start running it at all kinds of odd times so it doesn't become associated by other people in the house with only being turned on when adults are doing the dirty. Set personal space boundaries when your kids are old enough to understand them. That is, they don't enter your room without permission. Even if your door is open, they should ask for entry. As a general parenting rule, I suggest modeling this behavior in return. Ask permission to enter their space unless something is going on that dictates a courtesy override. Have another place to go if you are co-sleeping. Can you sneak off to the living room once the small people have finally dozed off? I know that a lot of this may seem like super basic, well, duh, stuff. But be honest. How dedicated have the two of you been to following through on doing this super basic stuff? It is usually the first things to fall wayside when things are hectic, but I can tell you from decades of experience as a therapist and a parent that attending to your relationship with your partner is the foundation for making everything else far easier to manage. The Consent Commandments. At its core, consent is simply permission for something to happen. If boundaries are the everyday expression of consent, then consent becomes the discussion surrounding our interactions. We have all had experiences of our boundaries being violated, and others not requesting permission to interact with us, especially when it comes to sex and intimacy. I am continuously surprised and not surprised by how often even my fellow clinicians in the field misunderstand the need for active consent in relationships. Consent provides a safe framework for interactions. For those of us with trauma histories, that is a very healing experience. And equally importantly, it allows us to own our own desires in a sex-positive way. You are having to be convinced. You're saying yes. 1. Consent for sex or other behaviors you are asking someone to engage in cannot be given by people who are drunk, or under the influence of drugs, or hardcore medications. People under the influence are already doing seriously dumb stuff, like craving those $2-for-$1 tacos from Jack in the Box. So don't add something to their regret list that has larger and longer-term consequences. 2. Going through a lot of emotional stuff can be just as bad for your decision-making process as being drunk. If someone is stressed out or dealing with a lot, they also may not be making the best decisions. They may be seeking comfort, and we often equate connection with others as sex. If you think someone isn't making a good decision, suggest that sex be put on hold and be there for them in other ways, something that won't embarrass them a week from now. 3. Consent isn't static. So I let you borrow my car last week. Maybe you brought it back with the gas tank empty and full of Jack in the Box wrappers, so I don't want you using it again. Maybe you took fantastic care of it, but I don't want you using it again for whatever reason. I'm heading out to Jack in the Box myself, maybe. Either way, it's still my car, not yours. You don't just march in my house, grab the keys off the counter, and take off in my car because I let you do it last week. No consent equals grand theft auto, right? Agreeing to something on one occasion does not mean consent forever. 4. Consent for one thing isn't consent for another. Someone gets naked in front of you? This is an excellent sign, yes. Is it consent for any specific sexual activity? No. Agreeing to any kind of activity isn't agreeing to all of them. Making out doesn't mean oral sex is cool. And oral sex doesn't mean penetrative sex. It's a salad bar. Wanting croutons doesn't mean you also have to have bell peppers, you know? 5. Silence isn't consent. Someone may not actively say no, but being passive isn't a yes. Many times individuals don't speak up because they are freaked out or don't know how to. They could be quietly freaking out or quietly enjoying themselves. You don't know if you don't ask. 6. Consent needs to be informed. Are you sleeping with other people? That's okay. It's called dating, not getting married for a reason. Have an STD? That happens too. Moving out of state in a week? That can impact future plans a bit. Potential partners need to know any information that may inform their decision about sexual activity. Be grown enough to have the awkward conversations. 7. Consent is a community obligation, not just a personal one. We need to help support each other with gray areas of consent. Speak up if you see someone in an uncomfortable situation and back up their right to say no. Friends don't let friends listen to Nickelback, and they don't let them get into situations where they are not really giving consent or not really getting consent from their partner or potential hookup. If you see someone at a party, for instance, getting into a danger zone, then be the protective wingman. And if the DJ plays Nickelback, it's time to leave altogether. 8. Having to convince someone is not consent. You aren't trying to win a court case by wooing a jury member. You're awesome, right? If they aren't into you enough to realize that and you have to convince them, then they don't deserve your awesomeness. If you get a, "Well, I don't know," respond with, "That's cool. Let me know if you change your mind," and then step away from the sex. 9. Consent doesn't just mean the right to say no. It also means the right to say yes. Shaming people, that is, calling them hoes, because they choose to engage in sexual activity makes active, enthusiastic consent way more complicated. Affirmative consent is difficult for many people, usually women, because they think that an enthusiastic yes means they are slutty, and that they are supposed to pretend they don't want sex and therefore must be convinced. This sends mixed messages to their partners. When are we supposed to convince, and when are we supposed to just stop? If everyone is sexually empowered, no one ever has to be convinced. 10. Consent is more than just sex. It's about boundaries in general. You should get people's permission to touch them for any reason. For example, "You look like you could use a hug right now. Would you like one?" Consent extends past physical boundaries as well. You should never force your will on others. Don't share others' information, experiences, images, or things without their permission. Don't make plans on their behalf without their permission. Don't force them to share information with you or anyone else if they are uncomfortable doing so. No matter what you think is in their best interest, unless you are their legal guardian, let them make their own decisions. You do you, and let them be them. Sexual touch. In part 1, I talked about the levels of touch. While all levels of touch are important, the ultimate goal of this book is to improve sexual intimacy. One of the most important ways of doing that is not only improving our communication about touch, but also finding true enjoyment in both giving and receiving touch from our partners. All relationships have a give and take, but except for the first pre-touch exercise, time should be set aside for the receiver to enjoy the experience without being expected to return the favor. Anthropologist Ashley Montague wrote in his book, touching, the human significance of skin, that sex is the highest form of touch. All forms of touch are important in our romantic partnerships, and all help foster a sense of intimacy. Though the ultimate goal is to build a more satisfying sexual relationship as part of our romantic partnerships. One of the biggest barriers to fostering this kind of intimate touch, both sexual and non-sexual, is the expectation of return demonstration. As in, if I give you a massage, you better put out. If I had a dollar for every time I heard tell of a similar exchange from couples, I would be writing this book from my chateau in the south of France. Instead, the giver should focus on the pleasure experienced in being the one giving pleasure, rather than focusing on what they get when it is their turn. Giving pleasure for its own sake to your partner can be its own intensely rewarding experience that fosters intimacy in and of itself. Sensate focus exercises were developed by Masters and Johnson to help couples work through intimacy issues. You can definitely answer the questions about the level of touch on your own and try some of the touch exercises alone in the name of solo body work. However, these exercises were intended as partnered work to build or rebuild intimacy and connection. Being touched by someone else is substantially different than touching oneself. Not better or worse, but different. And connecting to someone else through touch, focusing on your reaction to their body, can be a vitally important part of our own sense of self, not just our connection to them. There are many variations of these exercises out there. I designed my version to be both trauma-mindful and trauma-informed. Goals of the exercises: to learn how we like to be touched. To learn how our partner likes to be touched. To find new ways to explore our needs and desires. To find new ways of receiving and giving pleasure without focusing on immediate sexual release. To demonstrate to ourselves and our partner a commitment to our relationship. To help build connection and deepen our relationship with our partner. To become more comfortable with our physical selves as our bodies evolve and change through childbirth, aging, and/or disability. Establish ground rules. Determine if there are any areas that you do not want to have touched, and how you will communicate if that changes during the exercises. Consider a safe word or gesture if you are concerned that you may struggle with communicating fully. Decide ahead of time if you desire to be clothed, partially clothed, or naked during the earlier stage sensate touch exercises. Also consider how you will handle any unexpected outcomes. For example, one partner or both may become sexually aroused and want to engage in more than sensate touch. There is no rule, of course, that you cannot engage in activities other than sensate touch during your touch sessions. However, neither partner should feel pressured to do so. Having a plan on how to handle those issues ahead of time will help prevent hurt feelings or unfulfilled expectations that may arise. Discuss what you hope to accomplish from these exercises with your partner and whether or not you think these goals are being achieved. Discuss the positives and negatives of each encounter. Continue to do so in a way that demonstrates your own accountability for your thoughts and feelings using I statements. Pick a time and place where you will feel comfortable and won't be interrupted by other people or by the telephone, TV, or other intrusions. For the sensate focus exercises, consider doing them in the morning if a male partner is the receiver, as testosterone levels are highest in the morning. The receiver should state what feels good and what does not. Communicate this using I statements. I like it when, and I don't like, rather than you shouldn't or stop that. Positive redirection such as, I prefer it when, always feels best to the giving partner. Positive feedback in general is always preferred, especially noises of appreciation when your partner does something you especially enjoy. Additionally, The giver should ask for feedback about areas of touch, pressure, and technique. Consider learning from the receiver what they like by letting them guide your hand, especially at first. Consider using your non-dominant hand for times when a lighter touch is preferred. Use lighting that feels comfortable to you and music if you find that soothing. If you aren't using your bed for the initial exercises, which makes sense if that's become a source of pressure, you can still use plenty of pillows and blankets to feel comfortable wherever you are. Use lotions or oils for the massage exercises. Make sure to use one that is face-friendly for the face caress, like a moisturizing cream. For the sensate touch exercises that include genital stimulation, you may want to use a lubricant. This can be especially helpful if a female partner has issues producing enough lubrication due to menopause or other medical conditions, or if a male partner struggles to maintain a full erection. If you have not used lubricant before, read all the labels, and you may want to test it out on a small area on your skin to make sure you do not have an allergic reaction. Products that are hypoallergenic and/or organic tend to be safest if you are sensitive. Remember not to use oil-based lubrication when using condoms. These will break down the latex in the condom, or silicone-based lubricants when using silicone-based toys. Alternate being the giver and the receiver. You can take turns during the same occasion or set separate times so the receiver can fully enjoy the experience without having to return the favor after they are relaxed. As you notice your partner's response to receiving certain types of stimulation, also take time to focus on the sensations you feel as the giver. What does your partner's skin feel like? What does the part of your body touching them feel like as you move over their skin? Remember, the aim of these exercises is enjoyment, relaxation, connectedness, and pleasure. Focus on the journey rather than the end result. Feel free to find books or DVDs about massage to learn and try some different techniques. There is no time limit or limit to the number of sessions you spend on any exercise or stage. You can spend as much time as you want on each exercise before moving to the next one in order to establish comfort and trust. It is important that partners do not pressure each other to move forward until both are ready to do so. It can be very helpful to spend several weeks on a particular stage and exercise, incorporating a bit more of the body or areas of the body each time you practice. Pre-touch shared breathing exercise. Sit facing each other. Maintaining eye contact, slow your breathing and focus on breathing in unison. If you don't have medical issues that disrupt your breathing patterns, try to breathe in to the count of three, hold for the count of three, and release your breath for a count of three. Focus your thoughts on loving intent toward your partner, such as, "I choose you," or "I care for you." Continue this pattern for 2 minutes. 2 minutes will seem like a very long time the first time you try this. You can extend the time out if you feel comfortable doing so. You may continue these exercises over time, extending the amount of time you spend in shared breathing. Discuss the experience with your partner. What did you notice? Did anything make you uncomfortable? Was there anything you particularly enjoyed? The hand caress. Sit in a comfortable position, facing each other. Using a lotion or oil, gently rub your partner's hand. Spend 5 to 10 minutes on each hand, 10 to 20 minutes total. Check in with your partner about the amount of pressure you are using. Focus your thoughts on loving intent toward your partner, such as, "I choose you," or "I care for you." Discuss the experience with your partner. What did you notice? Did anything make you uncomfortable?